topics that run contrary to their interests in a professional fashion. People are aware. The free flow of information has raised people's awareness and educated people about media on an international scale. People tune into channels and websites that provide them with crucial information, those that they can't receive from American media. The US government and imperialism are aware of how effective these outlets are.
Press TV was established in 2005 and launched in 2007 with the motto, News Are New, to present alternative news, stories underreported or even unreported. 14 years on since its launching, it is still with all impediments forcing out the voice of the voiceless to the disdain of Western powers and some mainstream world media outlets and the Zionist occupiers of Palestine. The 24-hour news channel does so via a website, newsroom and programs department, using satellite transponders and social platforms. So you see why it's important we remain unhindered by Facebook or otherwise.
Although social networks claim to be completely independent, in practice you see that they are acting in accordance with the general policies of the United States. That is, they implement policies that don't conform to even their own instructions and laws. When the US government gives them orders, they easily follow them and disregard their own regulations to create restrictions for countries and governments. In this case, we also saw a similar pattern. I have been studying Facebook's terms and policies. There isn't a single article that Press TV hasn't adhered to. In fact, the channel's account has been complying with those exact terms.
That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do join us again next week and each week after, at least on the box, as you never know what's on. Bye for now.
The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
You are our true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Waiting for you to be by your side.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny, dear and sisters all over the world. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer some doubts or misconceptions on the very important issue and concept of Mahdawiya or Mahdism. In this series of shows, we have been trying to answer the doubts or misconceptions raised by a so-called scholar from extremist groups on this important topic of Mahdawiya. The concept of Mahdawiya is something that has been universally accepted by different religions, not only Islam. In different religions, Abrahamic religions, we see the expectation and waiting concept for the whole followers of religions. They are waiting for a last savior to come to save the humanity and save the world. So this is not something to be easily denied. That's why in this series of shows we are trying to analyze this concept and the issues around it meticulously through the eyes of the school of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. In this very show we shall focus on one misconception which says that narrations and traditions or hadith regarding Mahdawiya, regarding the beginning of occultation, looks contradictory. This is what we are going to ask from the respected guest speaker, Sheikh Murtada Karimi from Qom Seminary Schools, to shed some light and tell us what the reality is. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
Many thanks for accepting the invitation. Sheikh, the first question that we need to ask and discuss is the same topic that I introduced in the beginning, that is the narrations and traditions of Mahdawiya talking about the beginning of occultation or ghibah look contradictory. Is it true, Sheikh? Some say that Imam started his occultation 3 days after his birth, some say 40 days, some say 7 days. So which is true, and is it basically an innate contradiction in these series of hadith or not?
We know that Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, according to the Shia school of thought, he has two occultations, the minor one and the major occultation. Now, about the beginning of the minor occultation, most of the Shia scholars believe that it begins from the year, from the day Imam al-Askari alayhi salam was martyred, that is the year 260 after Hijra. And some Shia scholars believe that it begins from the day Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam was born, the year 255. But all agree that it was ended in the year 329, and then the major occultation began. But what is mentioned in this doubt is not related to this difference among the Shia scholars. Rather, this Wahhabi scholar tries to prove that still, I mean, he is mentioning different points to come to this conclusion that Mahdi, which is viewed by the Shia as the last Imam, is nothing but a myth. There is no reality about him. And he says that one of the reasons is that there are differences and contradictions in Shia narrations about the time that people were not able to see him anymore. Now, in this doubt, he mentioned four narrations, and he says that there are contradictions in these four narrations. And he says that in the first narration, we read that Hakima Khatun, she says that 3 days after the birth of Mahdi, I was eager to see him, so I went to the house of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. I went into the room where his mother was lying, but I was not able to see him. And then Imam al-Askari alayhi salam told me about the fact that he is under the protection of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and through the permission of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, people can see him. So this is the first narration, according to which 3 days after his birth, Hakima was not able to see him.
True.
Then according to another narration, after 7 days, Hakima was not able to see him. According to another narration, Hakima says that I saw Mahdi after 40 days and he was walking in the house and I did not see him after that.
Logically, if there are different narrations on the timing, it doesn't necessarily actually reach to this conclusion that there is no occultation or no occultation had happened. So, I mean, logically speaking, this conclusion has no relation to the introduction that was made. So, I mean, let's now hear from you. What is the exact, I don't know, what is the true understanding from a hadith that what day Imam actually started occultation?
That's true. So, regarding these narrations that this Wahhabi scholar has mentioned, first of all, the first answer is that all these narrations are weak. I can mention that in the first narration we have a person called Muhammad ibn Abdullah, and who is unknown. In the second narration we have a person called Musa ibn Muhammad, who is weak. The third narration is Mursal, meaning some of the narrators are not mentioned. If you want to have a very quick answer to this Wahhabi scholar, the point is that none of these narrations are authentic. But addressing the content of the narration, I think this Wahhabi scholar has made two mistakes. The first mistake is that he thinks that the only person who was able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam after his birth was Hakima Khatun and no one else. And that is why he is only referring to the times that Hakima was able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. But the point is that we mentioned, we discussed in details in the previous programs that many of the companions of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam were able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. So
very
to
true.
Give a key role only to Hakima Khatun in the story of the birth and occultation of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because they want to prove that it was only her who saw Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, who knew about the occultation of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, and all the stories are mentioned by him and no one else.
Wherever you be, I'll be with you.
'cause you're the one. My heart is to need you.
Shahana, can it be because Hakima Khatun was a lady and this person wants to divert all the attention only to this respected lady?
Yeah.
And ladies and the women right has no place in the eyes of extremist groups.
That's the point.
From this viewpoint, from this angle, he wants to weaken the old hadith
and even he mentioned explicitly that the Shia has based his views about Mahdi on a report of a lady. He mentions that explicitly, as you mentioned, to undermine and to weaken this belief and teaching. So the point is that this is not the case. We have met many other people. We mentioned the names in the previous programs. The second mistake...
And even if it was only this single lady who witnessed it, it had no problem, because Maryam salamullah alayha was the only lady who knew the story of Isa. I mean, the story of birth of Isa. So ladies are different. The ladies in the world, even the respect of the lady should be...
That's true, but
place.
When it comes to the narration, if we have... I mean, there is no difference between the narration that we receive from a lady or from a man. I mean, from this perspective, there is no difference. We
very
have narrations from the ladies in Shia collections of hadith. But yeah. The point is that if there is only her, then some people might call it khabar wahid, one narration narrated only by one
person. Same applies for men as well.
Yeah. Same applies for men, but we said that this is not khabar wahid. Many people
very
have
true.
Seen Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, so it's kind of mutawatir narration, meaning narrated through various chains of the narration. But the second and the main mistake is that he has thought that the occultation of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam in the minor occultation was all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And not gradual. But we believe that the occultation of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, I mean, the fact that he disappeared from eyes of the people in the minor occultation was something gradual. Let me explain it in more details. When we talk about the occultation of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, we mean that Imam did not appear in front of the people.
Mm-hmm.
It could be all at once, but the historical reports and the narrations tell us that it was somehow gradual. So, for example, it is mentioned that some of the Shia of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, they saw Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam one day after his birth, Kamal al-Din, page 430.
True.
In another narration, 7 days after his birth, Kamal al-Din, 431. 40 days after his birth, Kitab al-Ghiba by Sheikh al-Tusi, page 237. 2 days before martyrdom of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, Kitab al-Ghiba, page 239. Some days after the martyrdom of the Imam, Imam al-Askari, Kamal al-Din, 453. And again, after the martyrdom of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, Kamal al-Din, page 473. So to think that Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam disappeared from the eyes of all the Shia all at once, it is something wrong, and it is rejected by the narrations. The Shia needed time to come to this conclusion that Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam will go to a minor occultation and then the major occultation. So some of them were able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam after his birth, some after 7 days, 40 days after the martyrdom of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. So the point is that it was gradual, so that Shia get used to that. So that is why we see that Sheikh al-Mufid is one of the scholars who believe that the minor occultation of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam began at the time of the birth of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. But then he narrates some stories in which some of the Shia were able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam in his minor occultation. So what is the conclusion? The conclusion is that Sheikh al-Mufid believes minor occultation begins in 255. But again, some Shia are able to see the Imam. So this kind of, this notion of disappearance of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam from the eyes of the Shia was something gradual. It did not happen all at once. Also, we see that Sheikh al-Saduq and Sheikh al-Tusi, they have narrated these narrations which are mentioned by these Wahhabi scholars, but beside that, they have mentioned many stories according to which many Shia, many companions of Imam al-Askari al-Salam were able to see Imam al-Mahdi al-Salam. For example, the dear listeners can refer to Kamaluddin by Sheikh al-Saduq, page 434, and also Kitab al-Ghaybah by Sheikh al-Tusi, page 229. So the point is that according to these scholars, the beginning of the occultation of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam is not the last visit of Hakim al-Khatun with Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. I think we need to continue our discussion in our upcoming session. Time is almost over and we have to finalize the discussion here. We have been talking about the hadith and narrations that emphasize the beginning and the starting point of occultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and it was witnessed that Imam was seen by different companions, including Lady Hakim Khatun salamullah alayha. And this will be, inshallah, continued in our upcoming session. Sheikh Nasser, thank you very much, and you, respected listeners, many thanks for staying tuned and listening to the La Sabia from IRIB English Radio. We'll meet again in our next session. I'd like to invite you to join us again. Till then, I'll leave you in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. O Allah, protect your representative, Al-Hujjah bin al-Hasan, Imam al-Mahdi, and send salutation upon him and his ancestors, now as well as all the times. Be his guardian, protector, guide, and assistance. Help him in his path and be watchful for him till you let him rule over the earth willingly and cause him to live in it for a long time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box 19395-1 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Risks shoot up when virus particles accumulate in buildings, but it's not clear how best to improve ventilation, says Diane Lewis, author, in an article published under the heading Why Indoor Spaces Are Still Prime COVID Hotspots. Stay tuned for more. When Lydia Morozka leaves home, she takes with her a slick shoe-sized device that provides some sobering insights about the restaurants and offices she visits. Outside these buildings, her carbon dioxide monitor reads just above 400 parts per million, but indoors is a different story. Even in a seemingly spacious, high-ceilinged restaurant, the number sometimes shoots up as high as 2,000 ppm, a sign that the room has poor ventilation and could pose a risk for COVID-19 infection. Visual cues can be deceptive, even for Morozka, an aerosol scientist from Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia. The general public has no idea about this, she says. The situation is no different inside cafes or kindergartens around much of the world, according to researchers who have wielded similar handheld CO2 meters. And that's bad news for hopes of defeating the coronavirus SARS-CoV-2. For months, health authorities have singled out indoor spaces with poor ventilation as potential infection hotspots. And on March 1st, the World Health Organization, WHO, released a long-awaited roadmap to better ventilation. The document, which Morozka contributed to, sets out specific targets and measures that businesses and other places can take to improve ventilation and make buildings safer. But Philomera Blusin, a building engineer at the Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands, says that more needs to be done. The WHO guidelines, she says, are the minimum. Blusin and others are critical of government's failure to provide clear guidance or money for people to make indoor spaces safer. Some scientists say that has been large swathes of the population, from school children to office workers, restaurant goers, and prisoners at risk of catching COVID-19. Others say that there is no easy fix, and the precise ventilation or air purification regimes to make indoor spaces safe are not known. The complexity is not at a level that you can, with a simple set of advice, resolve it, says Ehsan Musavi, a construction engineer at Clemson University in South Carolina, who studies indoor air quality and ventilation in hospitals. Still, many experts say that enough is known for authorities to provide clear message about how important good ventilation is for safety indoors, especially in spaces that are continuously occupied or where masks are removed when eating. on March 28, 2020, 2 months after the WHO had declared COVID-19 a global health emergency, the agency broadcast a public health message on Twitter and Facebook. Facts: COVID-19 is not airborne, it said, labeling claims to the contrary as misinformation. But evidence quickly established that the virus is transmitted by air, and researchers roundly criticized the agency. WHO updated its advice on SARS-CoV-2 transmission 3 months later, acknowledging the possibility that airborne transmission might occur in some community settings. Airborne transmission in crowded and inadequately ventilated spaces over a prolonged period of time with infected persons cannot be ruled out, the updated advice says. Yuku Li, a building environment engineer at the University of Hong Kong, says that he is disappointed it took the WHO and other health authorities so long. We would have saved a lot of people if airborne transmission was recognized earlier, he says. A WHO spokesperson says the agency has mentioned the importance of ventilation since early in the pandemic. Others say that the WHO's position still doesn't go far enough. Airborne transmission is dominant, says environmental epidemiologist Joseph Allen at Harvard University's T.H. Chan School of Public Health in Boston, Massachusetts. That's why building controls such as ventilation and air filtration makes sense, he says. The WHO and other health authorities have failed to clearly prioritize measures to improve indoor air quality to reduce the chance of catching COVID-19, says Jose Luis Jimenez, an atmospheric chemist at the University of Colorado at Boulder. They don't emphasize how important it is, he says. What the WHO needs to say is, fact, it goes through the air, says Jimenez. We breathe it in. A stark message from the WHO would ensure that national health authorities take notice, says Jimenez. Australia, the Netherlands, and some other nations still do not acknowledge in their public statement that airborne transmission has a significant role in spreading the SARS-CoV virus. By the start of this year, concerns over ventilation had reached the boiling point. Hundreds of healthcare workers, scientists, engineers, and occupational health and safety experts signed open letters calling on government officials in Canada, the United States, Australia, Colombia, and the UK to address, among other things, poor indoor air quality. These concerted campaigns all urged local or national governments to take steps to reduce airborne transmission of SARS-CoV-2. One of the problems is that governments and businesses are still spending millions of dollars on surface disinfection, says Jimenez, despite evidence that it is rare for SARS-CoV-2 to pass from one person to another through contaminated surfaces. By contrast, few countries have invested in measures to improve indoor air quality. If we took half the efforts that's been given to disinfection and we put it on ventilation, that will be huge, Jimenez says. In October, Germany set aside 500 million euros to improve ventilation in public buildings, including schools, museums, and public offices. Businesses in Germany and South Korea can also apply for government funding to purchase mobile air purifiers that remove virus-laden aerosols. In the United States, by contrast, federal funding to improve indoor air quality was limited to healthcare providers such as hospitals until the American Rescue Plan Act, which also provides funding for schools, became law on March 11th. What makes indoor spaces so dangerous is that the virus can accumulate and infect people who do not have direct contact with an infected person. A prime example happened a year ago in Vietnam. 12 people became infected at a restaurant, but only 4 had close contact with the infected person. More recent outbreaks at gyms in Chicago, Illinois, and Hawaii have also occurred despite physical distancing of the attendees and capacity limits on fitness classes. Ever since the WHO acknowledged last year that airborne transmission could happen, public health agencies have emphasized the risk in crowded and poorly ventilated spaces. But the terminology is deceptive, says Morosco. You imagine a busy restaurant, she says. In reality, any place can become crowded and poorly ventilated, and people don't realize this. Her own modestly sized office at the Queensland University of Technology quickly becomes poorly ventilated if someone visits and the door is closed, she says. And spacious, uncrowded restaurants can appear to be well ventilated when they are not. It's one of the reasons that Jimenez and others advocate the use of inexpensive CO2 monitors as a rough measure of whether ventilation is adequate or not. As virus-carrying aerosols are exhaled, so too is CO2. And when ventilation is poor, CO2 accumulates along with the virus, says Jimenez. In an unreviewed analysis, Jimenez and his co-author Zhi Peng found that SARS-CoV-2 infection risk rises along with CO2 concentrations indoors.
The debate.
Hello, everyone. Warm welcome to the debate show. I'm your host, Usna Shafi. There was backlash in Britain today over a government-commissioned report that critics argue whitewashes the state of race relations in the country. The Prime Minister's most senior black advisor has also resigned, but number 10 Downing Street saying it's got nothing to do with the report. Divisive, insulting, and deeply cynical are the words that critics have used to describe that report. Prime Minister Johnson has acknowledged serious issues exist as regards racism in Britain that need to be addressed. The question is, how deep-rooted is racism in the UK? Is the problem there to stay? Let's begin this debate with this report.
The Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities says the UK system is not rigged against people from ethnic minorities and there is no proof of institutional racism. In a report released Wednesday, it did admit that minorities still face overt racism, but insisted Britain should be regarded as a, quote, model for other white-majority countries.
The report definitely touched a nerve, suggesting that disparities based on race in the economy and education are negligible. But people here in Brixton definitely disagree.
They live in their little tower and they've grown up in a certain way, but they don't see the reality of what black people are actually going through. So no, there is racism and we are not hung up. We need to just be heard that something is wrong with our bringing up our lives and how we are actually treated. Because in reality, we are seen as a different colour.
Institutional racism does exist. It exists in the education system everywhere. You can see it in a classroom. A teacher would discriminate against a black student over a white student just because he's black.
The report has been slammed as nonsense that flies in the face of all existing evidence. Flagged up are many issues that black and minority ethnics grapple on a daily basis. For example, the fact that black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched by police than white people, and black mothers are 4 times likely to die in childbirth. So is this a genuine effort to understand racism in Britain or a PR stunt? Many black artists share the view that racism today is alive and well. Junior from the British Collective says his life and career were deeply impacted by racism.
When I was a kid and I was growing up, if I played football and a white guy kicked me, I would have turned around and I might have effed him blind. But it wouldn't have crossed my mind to call him white. Vice versa, the first thing that he would do is turn around and say, "You black, so and so." Not understanding for himself that he's being racist, he just took it as the norm. It hasn't changed since then. It hasn't changed in any shape, form, or fashion. I hear some politicians trying to turn it into, black politicians trying to turn it into a, oh, well, we've come a long way. We haven't.
The COVID-19 pandemic and the disproportionate number of deaths among black, Asian, and minority ethnic people clearly illustrate that something is seriously wrong. Being much more likely to have to live in a block of flats and do a job involving a high level of exposure to the public are the sort of factors that critics say prove systemic or structural racism is real. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Okay, now let's get down to business. Joining me in this debate tonight will be former Deputy Mayor of London, Lee Jasper, out of London, and also British political activist and writer, Jackie Walker, who's joining us out of Kent. Good to have both of you on the show, gentlemen. Now, beginning with my first question, Lee, the opposition trade unions and campaigners have called the report shallow, naive, and politically motivated. What's your assessment of the report?
I think that assessment about sums it up. We've had a report that has been delivered by a commission that was specifically chosen by the Prime Minister and his aides, special advisors, because they were deeply sceptical, and a matter of public record, of being very deeply sceptical about the existence of institutional racism. And of course, as a consequence of electing a commission who had that political viewpoint, it's no surprise that we've reached this stunning conclusion. What is interesting, of course, is that the backlash to this report has been absolutely universal.
Okay. Now, Jackie, some campaigners have also described the report as a whitewash after the government commissioned, you know, report claimed that there is no evidence that the UK is institutionally racist. What's your take?
Well, it's actually worse than a whitewash, actually. This is an act of fundamental propaganda, but it has to be seen in the context of a whole range of responses that this government are making, not just to issues of race, but to issues of poverty and inequality and policing as well. I mean, what happens is, you know, there is a problem, whatever the problem is, for example, violence from police, and the government set up an inquiry, which is fixed. And we all know what the outcome is going to be. And then the outcome exonerates the police, or it exonerates government, or whatever, and that's supposed to make us feel fine. This time, I think the backlash is so strong, nobody is going to be happy with that. And in some ways, I think coming so soon after what's happened with Meghan Markle, I think this is actually, in a way, something that's quite good for the black community, because it makes it absolutely clear what our position is within British society.
Now, Lee, the British government report comes several weeks after an interview by Prince Harry and his wife, Meghan. Also, Jackie just made a mention of that. And in that, they said that the British royal family was concerned about how dark the skin of their children might be. Is it not an indication that racism is institutionalized in Britain, even at the highest level of the political establishment?
Of course. I mean, the royal family is the representation of the ultimate white supremacist royal family. I mean, there is no doubt about that. Their history is steeped in that tradition. And although they appear to say the right words in relation to the Commonwealth and diversity, the Queen has never apologised for colonialism or transatlantic slavery, never apologised at least people of African descent and Asian descent for their atrocities during that period. So we're very clear about the nature of the royal family, and Meghan Markle, you know, provided a bright light to that. But I also think that, look, this report is falling apart at the seams. Today that the Prime Minister's Special Race Advisor resigned as a consequence of that. Today we've seen reported that the specialist advisors, professors, commissions, the King's Fund, which is a health inequality board, have all put out statements to say that they weren't consulted, neither did they feed in to this report, although they've been cited as doing so in it. So it's a report that is falling apart at the seams. Boris Johnson is already distancing himself from the report. His special advisor has resigned, and the black community is united in a way that I haven't, frankly, seen for a long time in opposing this government piece of propaganda. On that, Jacqueline's absolutely right.
Jackie, a 2019 Oxford University report found that black Britons and those of South Asian origin faced as much discrimination in the labor market as they did in the late 1960s and 70s. You know, black mothers have worse outcomes during pregnancy or childbirth than any other ethnic group in England. And that shows the situation in several decades later has not improved for minority groups. What do you make of these facts and figures?
Well, I mean, if you look at any range of outcomes by a huge range of organizations and academics, it totally, totally contradicts what this report is. But what's very clear is this is a very political exercise which is going on now. And I think we have to recognize that one of the reasons why that is happening is because of the lack of any real opposition now, either within the British media or actually within our political system. Because, you know, I would ask, where are our spokespeople in terms of what's supposed to be the official opposition? So what we have here is a real vacuum and a swing towards the right and a swing towards racism. I came to this country in 1959. I was part of that Windrush migration. And I have seen a lot of progress within race relations, and I've also seen a lot of backstep. I have to say, I have never known the situation to be so bad as it is now, not since I was a child.
Ali, a study by the Office of National Statistics in June 2020 found that black people are almost four times more likely to die of COVID-19, while Asians are up to twice as likely to die. And then the report 4 months later by the Office for National Statistics concludes that black people and those from South Asian ethnic backgrounds have high risks of death from COVID-19 compared to those of white ethnic backgrounds. So what's your rating of this data, and why do minority groups are hit the hardest?
Because those minority groups are affected by systemic racism that impacts upon their incomes, that has a consequent effect on their quality of life, that steeps them into long generational paths of unemployment and poverty and child poverty. And they're in the kind of occupations that are very much public-facing, whether that's doctors within the NHS, nurses in the NHS, or whether that's people in the transport systems. And so we've seen the evidence of the collateral damage of institutionalized systemic racism being played out in our communities. And it's against that backdrop, and let's remember, against the backdrop of the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement after the death of George Floyd, that this commission was announced. But it's done no more than completely undermine any notion that this government is taking seriously the issue of systemic racism, which is, look, you pointed it out in the facts and figures. These are matters of life and death for our community. And this report is a joke. Not only is it intellectual and incoherent, it carries no credibility, but it's actually a grievous insult to African, Caribbean and Asian communities who have lost loved ones during the course of this pandemic because of their overexposure as a result of systemic institutionalized racism and disadvantage.
Okay. Now, Jackie, we have this data by UK police indicating a rise of 300% in hate crimes against Chinese and East and Southeast Asians in the first quarter of 2020. How do you foresee this trend unfold? I mean, is the UK in a position to serve as a role model for other white majority countries as recommended in this controversial report?
I certainly don't think it can even suggest that it can be a role model. But can I just add here?
Sure.
I think we have to be really clear that the purpose of this report has got nothing to do with minorities. It has nothing to do with black people. This is not a report for black people. It's a report for the establishment, the ruling class, and the majority white community. It is so that they can feel that they don't have to actually respond to either what's happened at COVID or what's happened to Black Lives Matter. And I just want to add something which Lee Jasper brought up about issues around history and the slave trade, because it's actually worse than that. When Cameron, the Prime Minister, the late Prime Minister, went to Jamaica, one thing he said to Jamaicans was, it is time you got over that. Mm. And that is the big message of this report, not just in terms of the specific paragraphs in which they were really quite insulting, basically saying that what black people, you know, the descendants of these enslaved people should do is actually think about how great it was that we were given the opportunity to sort of remake ourselves as black and British. It's not just that. It's actually, we should forget what happened to us. Well, I have to say, we are not going to forget. It doesn't matter how much they try and change what we're taught, we will not forget, and we will keep pressing for justice.
Okay. Lee, is the British political establishment doing enough for the elimination of this issue, or is it just paying it lip service? Because, you know, Johnson was saying that there are serious issues that need to be addressed.
Well, we saw race inequality under Boris Johnson as he feared as mayor in London, massively increased for black Londoners. We saw civil disturbances break out as a consequence of the shooting of Mark Duggan in Tottenham by the Metropolitan Police, who said that he had his gun in his hand, and at which the inquest and subsequent inquiry proved he didn't have a gun in his hand at the point he was shot. We know very well the tokenistic and performative responses of Boris Johnson, who for PR purposes will say anything, but is a committed hard right, extreme right, actually, libertarian free marketer. You know, he's in the category of Trump and Orban and people of this character, and represents, you know, the last gasp of white supremacists who are holding on into power. It's precisely what the melancholy exercise of Brexit is about. There's some feeble attempt to restore Britain's power and glory as a former and faded British empire. They have no doubt about Boris Johnson's not just lack of commitment to race and equality, but absolute antagonistic and hostility towards it. You know, his minister said that teaching anti-racism should be considered a crime. Teaching anti-racism in colleges and university should be considered a crime. And that's his black minister, Kimi Badenoch. So we're under no illusions about this prime minister at all.
So, Jackie, the question is now, what can be done about this? Is the issue of racism, this is current, is it there to stay in the UK?
Well, we're here to stay. This is our country. My children and my grandchildren are in this country, and I have a right to be here. And black people will continue to do, you know, what black people have done who are in the diaspora in Europe and in the Americas, which is we will continue to struggle for our own emancipation, and we'll do that with our white allies, of which we have many, and we will fight for a socialist and radical change of government.
And Lee, what's your prediction? What do you foresee could be happening in the future weeks and months to come? Could, like, movements and demonstrations like BLM happen also in the UK?
I think we're going to see a massive explosion of Black Lives Matter protests. We've had recent deaths in custody here in the UK, in Wales, of Mohammed Hassan and Moyed Bashir. We've had massive examples of police oppression taking place in arrest of Black Lives Matter protesters. I think we're going to see a summer of discontent in this country. I think that this is a direct provocation by this government in terms of this report. It's a declaration of war on black people and anti-racists. And I think here Johnson has, to use a Jamaican proverb, has hung his hat where his hand can't reach it. And the consequences of that will be massive Black Lives Matter demonstrations throughout the summer. That's what I would hope. That's what I'll be working for. And that's what we'll start putting on the streets actually from tomorrow in Parliament Square.
And Jackie, is it only this government or maybe some other government in future? Maybe they could do something about racism. Are you optimistic?
I'm optimistic because I think we always have to be optimistic for change. But I don't expect change to come easily. We're never given our freedom. Equality is never offered to us. We are ruled by a tiny elite. Who own most of the wealth in this country, and they're certainly not going to give that up easily. But we will do as we have always done, which is to struggle against them, you know. So I'm optimistic that in the end, we will better our situation. Am I short-term optimistic? I'm optimistic that we will fight against this government. Am I optimistic that the opposition or other formal political parties will assist us in this way? No, I'm not. The change will come from the street.
And Lee, your final comments?
I think the change will come from the streets. You know, we've seen Black Lives Matter movement around the world do more, push the dial on racism in a way that all of the political parties, liberal democratic parties, I've done over the last 20 years and seen astounding progress in very many areas. So I think the signal to our communities is clear. Just as in climate change, just as in the anti-racism movement, and it's when you go on the streets, when you mass protest, is when you achieve the greatest and radical change. And I think that because we're guaranteed the support of the majority of people in this country to put that message